lesson that's talking about ups and downs in our spiritual life. So somebody could start off, read paragraph 0.
My dear Lord, you have great hopes that the patient's religious faith is dying away, thank you. But my eyes thought that the training college was going to teach you to put old luck at competitive. And now I'm sure. Has no one ever told you about the law of undulation? Humans are individuals, not spirit, not human. But any determination to produce such a revolting factor is one of the things that determines. As one of the things that determined our fathers to withdraw their support from us. As spirit, they belong to the eternal world, but in formal, they can't respond. Which means that while their spirit can be directed to an eternal object, their bodies, passions, and imaginations are in continual change. So it takes some time to change. The nearest approach to consciousness, therefore, one day, when you feel the return to love, to make sure you repeatedly call back. A series of processes. If you have watched the patient carefully, you will assume this modulation in every department of the body. His interest in his work, his affection for his friends, his physical appetite, all go up in there. As long as he lives on earth, periods of emotional and bodily richness and liveliness will alternate in series of moments and problems. The dryness and dullness through which the patient's head is now going are not in defined clothes we work into. They are merely a natural phenomenon that reveals no greatness in its previous
life. Okay. Anybody in here experience this undulation? You go through periods of excitement and enthusiasm, and then periods of time whenever you're not so excited and blasé in your attitude. Not just about the church and spiritual things, but in most aspects of your life. Perhaps your job, feelings for somebody else that's close to you. Got anything you can think of?
No. I think it's probably something that I would like to ask you the question, but I was curious about what it mentioned that you described. Humans and students have spirits and have animals. I got a problem.
It's not really our definition of amphibian.
But no, I've heard people say we are, you know, we're animals. We made the fear of God, and we are not animals. We just act like it sometimes. But
but would you agree that we are both physical and spiritual?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Who's saying this too?
Right. Of course, this is a demon saying this. Yeah. So he views us as animals.
Yeah.
And so I think that's how you could attribute to the saying. He calls us a lot worse things in his description. But yeah, he's saying that because we're part spiritual and part human. Or part physical, that the physical part of us goes through highs and lows. And like I said, you probably think about it in your own life. Some days you're happy to go to work and excited, and other days you really don't want to drag yourself out of bed and say there's got to be a better way to make a living. With everything else, to include church. Sometimes our family will go through a period of time where we take on more and more and more things, and then we go through a period of time where it's like, okay, I need to simplify my life. I need to turn this and this and this over to somebody else. And so, this is what he means by the law of undulation. We see it also when we start something new. The law of undulation. When you start something new, you're enthusiastic and you're excited about it. It doesn't matter what it is, if you're starting a class, if you're learning to play musical instruments, or whatever it is that you've decided that you're going to do. You start off, and it's a lot of fun, and you're enthusiastic, and you throw your whole self into it, and then it gets difficult. With anything that you're doing, you go through the easy part, and then it starts to get harder, more and more difficult. It could have been in the training for your job, or something that you wanted to do. You see see it a lot whenever people decide to learn a new language. Decide, okay, I've just always wanted to speak Greek, Spanish, German, French, Russian, Japanese. How hard can it be? And so you take the first few lessons, you're like, oh yeah, I'm picking up so much, this is so easy, and then it gets difficult. And then you get into the harder things, and you lose your enthusiasm. And that's where a lot of times people stop doing something. They started doing it. You always see it right after the Winter Olympics. Because you see people out there ice skating and skiing and all these things, and they make it look so easy. Because anytime somebody is good at something, they make it look easy. And you say, well, I could do that. And so people go and try it. And you see right after the Winter Olympics, all these kids taking ice skating lessons. And whenever you come back 6 or 8 months later, about half of them are gone. Because the initial enthusiasm wore off, and then it got to that level. So, well, it got cost too. That's what we see in our everyday life.
I think that when I see this, it reminds me of some of the things you read about marriage. And, you know, they talk about a honeymoon period, and I've read things that people have said about that. That's just how marriage is, and it's not forever. And other people say we become a throwaway society. It depends on what point of view you're reading. But you especially with these celebrities, you know, oh, I'm so in love with this person, I can't imagine being with anyone else, and then it lasts usually less than a couple of years, and it just fell apart. And I don't know, for some reason that was what stuck in my mind there. Yeah, the thing is you've got to stick whatever this is out through the low times, and people don't like you, like you said.
Well, I know. The idea of treating spouses like laptops, where you have one for a while and you're excited about
that's
it,
great.
And then it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and then 3 years later, 3 years later, it's like, I'm getting tired of this. But that's true, and our relationships with each other are a good analogy for our relationship with God as well. The Bible uses that same analogy for a marriage, for our relationship with God. And you do see that where when people first either get into a relationship or when they first get married, and life is blissful, and then you discover all of the horrible things about the person that you didn't know, like they don't put the cat back on the toothpaste, they don't jump out of bed and make up the bed immediately. They want to just leave it unmade because they say, well, I'm just going to get back in again in about 16 hours. So you find out that
Michael was like that.
Absolutely. And so the newness wears off, and the honeymoon phase ends. So, what have you seen with new Christians? Because that's the context that Screwtape is writing about here, is that Wormwood's patient is a new Christian. And he starts off by saying he thinks the patient's religious phase is dying away. What do you think?
I think that's really very true. And it also depends on who is around the new Christian. Is that support in someone that is helping them to learn to keep going, it makes it easier. But left on your own, a lot of times you have to think it's going to be away. I mean, that's the way I feel. I had a hard time with that without having to do it.
Sometimes it's kind of the youth rally syndrome, where kids go to a youth rally and they get all excited and enthusiastic, or a Christian camp. Something like that. They go to some kind of a youth activity. They get all enthusiastic. They're baptized and they're on fire for a few months, and then they come back and something else is death to their ego.
I think maybe that's the main reason why we want to be together. So we need that support. We need that encouragement. If left on our own, yeah, it's a lot easier to sit there and on your own and say, okay, I'm going to do it today, but tomorrow,
that's
like, I got something else to do.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They say whenever a new Christian comes into the congregation, if they don't make contact or bond with somebody within about 6 months, something like this.
Yes.
Well, it's one of the phenomena you can see sometimes in churches. They will evangelize and they'll get people, you know, to the point of where they want to be baptized, but they have a hard time retaining them. A lot of times, I think, at least in some places, what we end up doing inadvertently is instead of bringing people to Christ, you know, we bring them to the church and we convert them to the church. And that's always a big letdown, you know, after a few months, because we're all imperfect. And I've just seen that happen before where, you know, the church was preached so much, not so much Christ crucified, you know, but the church, and people convert to that. Right? And that's always doomed to failure. You know, you have to bring people to Christ. Okay. That people have to be converted to Him, you know, not to the church.
And I've seen that where you bring in somebody new based on a sales pitch of, come to our church. You know, we've got a gym and we have potlucks every other week and there's all these great activities and groups, you know, we love these group activities that we do, and you should see our VBS, and people come in because of all of the things the church is doing, not because of the reason for being a Christian. We kind of miss out on the point. But, and it's not that it's a bad thing to bring people in like that, but we need to understand that their faith is only going to be that deep. That's the sole reason why they come to church. So we're going to read in the next few paragraphs how Satan tries to use this law of undulation, if you want to call it that. What can we do knowing that this law exists? Knowing how human nature is, how people's interest in things, enthusiasm goes up and down. What can we do about it?
Right perspective, the ups and downs, and keeping them at your lows, you're not by yourself. And with Christ on your side, you have somebody to always turn to. I may let you down as a human being, but God might let you down. So approach them with the highs and lows. You have a resource that nobody else out there in the world will have in your lows. You have a resource that nobody else has out there on your high to celebrate with. And I think if you put it, not just what we're talking about is the church aspect of it, because you as an individual, I'm going to let you down one point or another, that's just because I'm making mistakes. But to get them into, like you're saying, convert them to Christ, and when you're down, you have somebody to turn to in those down times that you think you don't. And I think if you get them along that line, it helps. Because when they're really down, that's where it comes down to, desperate.
C.S. Lewis has exposed a real deep insight into a truism of our life. We do have ups and downs. I mean, it's the nature. Unless you're super hyperactive and you're always up on the high, one day you're going to fall in with you that way. We have our ups and downs. Satan knows that. That's a great tool. He'll leave us alone when we're up there. But we start getting down, then he starts pecking away at us. Our problem is, when we get in our lows, we start looking upon ourselves as not as failures. You know, we're not doing what we're supposed to do. Particularly when we're relating that to within the work of the Lord's church. And what we're doing then is taking on a role, this is my church. My church is not doing too well. This is not your church. This is God's church. And he's going to do what he wants to with his church. All he wants us to do is work as hard as we can work and then let him take care of the rest of it. But we want to take that on to ourselves and, oh, but we're failures here. You know, we're not doing this. We're not going here. We're not having all this. When, in fact, we've taken on exactly the role that Satan wants us to take on. We forgot. We left God out of the picture. We put it all back on ourselves.
How would you know what it's like if you don't have it?
But in my eyes, I know
to be able to do it.
And I appreciate that.
But they felt really good.
All right. That's a discussion. We can move transition in the next paragraph.
To decide what the best use of it is, you must ask what use the enemy wants to make of it and then do the opposite. Now, it may surprise you to learn that in his efforts to get permanent possession of a soul, he relies on the troughs even more than the peaks. Some of his special favorites have gone through longer and deeper troughs than anyone else. The reason is this. To us, a human is primarily good. Our aim is the absorption of its will into ours, the increase of our own area of selfhood at his expense. But the obedience which the enemy demands of men is quite a different thing. One must face the fact that all the talk about his love for men, his service being perfect freedom, is not, as one would gladly believe, mere propaganda, but an appalling truth. He really does want to fill the universe with a lot of loathsome little replicas of himself, creatures whose life on its miniature scale will be qualitatively like his own, not because he has absorbed them, but because their wills freely conform to his. We want cattle who can finally become food.
Keep going, since that is the sense.
He wants servants who can finally become sons. We want to suck in. He wants to give out. We are empty and would be filled. He is full and flows over. Our war aim is a world in which our Father below has drawn all other beings unto himself. The enemy wants a world full of beings united in him, but still distinct. And that is where the troughs come in. You must have often wondered why the enemy does not make more use of his power to be sensibly present to human souls in any degree he chooses at any moment. But you now see that the irresistible and the indisputable are the two weapons which the very nature of his scheme forbids him to use. Merely to override a human will, as his felt presence in any but the faintest and most mitigated degree would certainly do, would be for him useless. He cannot ravish. He can only woo.
Okay. He talks about some of his special favorites that have gone through the peaks and valleys, which Bible characters came to mind whenever he was saying.
Job was the front of the list.
He definitely has some peaks and valleys.
Bang, yeah.
Okay. What about some others? David. David also came to mind. He was at the very peak, he was about the lowest low also.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Not lower Moses as well. Okay. I mean, these were the highest part of society at points in their lives, and then the lowest of the low at various times in their lives. And that is true of their physical lives, as far as their position in society. What about their moods? You've seen people in the Bible who you can tell their moods swung up and down. So tell me about biblical moods.
I think David would be definitely a good example of that. The way God chose him, God nurtured him. But yet, and he was, he wanted to do what God wanted him to do. He was there for him, but yet, he didn't always do what was right. I mean, he did some really opposite of what you would have thought of him. And especially with the closeness that he had with God. So in his spiritual life, he did have a lot of ups.
Okay. All right. And there's something unique about David in that many times the Bible just tells us what somebody did, not what they thought. Mm-hmm. We have an insight into David's thoughts because he wrote so many songs. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we can know not only what he did, how he acted, but what was on his mind. And as you read the songs, there are songs psalms where you can tell he's on top of the world. And there are definitely psalms where you can tell he sits in the deepest valley of his life.
Well, even Jesus had some emotions. Like when he came to raise Lazarus, and like, oh, it's hopeless. And then in the garden, he's like, I know I have to do this, but you could tell that he wasn't looking forward to having to go through this because he was human, and that's him.
I think Moses
definitely a change. I just brought down an entire new law. You know,
and you're down here.
It's going to change the entire way that we do this and live our lives. And falling away.
Plus a lot of people, didn't he?
Yeah, you know.
And, I mean, and rightly so. There were things that, but yeah, you, a lot of it is that, you know, you're doing this and this and this and this. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, that he was just, you know, so high our tank that I think a lot of folks really had a problem with him. You know, maybe, you know, with some of his detractors, that's what it was. It was a personal thing.
He even admitted that.
Yeah.
And like, it's somewhere at one point. He said, you know, I write these letters and whenever I appear to people in person, sometimes they're kind of disappointed in what they expected whenever I got there.
I think that's true. The intensity is what, even if you talk about it, you know, it's not there. Like, I do think they don't want to do it. They don't want to do it. So he's still struggling with it. And that's what I'm really worried about. So, yeah, he was easy.
John the Baptist said, hey, before, you know, I'm about to have my head cut off here, I just want to make sure I was right on this, okay?
Make one last appeal there to Jesus. It's like, I didn't waste my life here, but you are the right one, right? Be reassured.
I like that. The paragraphs are particularly good. Steps out here and talks about the nature of God, you know, how he deals with them. It's a really powerful set of words.
Opening my mouth to discuss that, so
I figured that's where you're going. Yeah, well, especially that final sentence, you know, he cannot ravage his own to do. And that, you know, that kind of, you know, he explains the battle, Satan's toolkit, you know, he doesn't forbid him anything, himself, and anything he can get away with, he will. There's certain things God won't do. Just by his very nature, you know, it would be useless to do so. And that answers the question, you know, why did God make me just a robot and say, well, we can form to his will? You know, that's not what God's about. He really does want to fill the universe with a lot of little motion built because of himself. You know?
Good point of view,
yeah.
Sometimes we tend to think, you know, God, why don't you step into this situation? Why don't you just miraculously help Japan recover from this situation that they're in right now? Sometimes we almost expect that of God. I think is that he's going to come in and perform some miracle on the equivalent level of parting the Red Sea and make his presence known to people. These two paragraphs talk about that, especially whenever it comes to human will. So many times we pray, you know, there's somebody that I've been wanting to accept the gospel. God, help me out. You know, help them to accept your word. And one of the things it says is merely to override a human will as this felt presence in even the faintest and most mitigated degree would certainly do would be for him useless. Why is that? Why doesn't God just make himself so obviously known that there is no doubt?
Well, he did that. You know, if it didn't work, I would refer you to the Old Testament.
That's a good point.
I've been asked this question, you know, if God just would appear to us, everybody would believe it. I'm like, you know, over and over and over, you know, with the children of Israel. And it lasted generations. You know, and it'd be right back to worship and Baal, or whoever the local god you sure happened to be. The rich man Lazarus. I mean, isn't that what the rich man asked for? Let me go back, or, you know, someone go back and warn my brother. And, you know, Moses told him, says, even if somebody rises from the dead, you're not going to convince everybody.
Like literally true. So why is it that God doesn't intervene in our lives in a more personal way? Take care of those valleys.
That is a good free will. It's like how great that love is. They're forced to it. They'll do it out of fear or better do this. This is what happened to me. What love would you have for God if you did it in a respectful way?
Kidnapping them, it doesn't work. And that does not make the person love them. That makes the person hate them and fear them. And that's what God wants to avoid. He doesn't want to twist our arms. He wants it to be our idea. Because that's the way a marriage relationship works. You're keeping the other person from leaving you by putting bars on the doors and locking them in the house whenever you leave. That's not love. That's not a relationship. Not what God wants in his relationship with us.
I think it also shows the distinction between animal and the creation of God. Most animals, we force our wills up on them. You know, you see a dog or a cat, we make them do what we want them to do. God makes that distinction. You know, you have free will. You're my creation, and you, basically what he's doing is giving the control back to us to decide where we want to go, what we want to do. And by us choosing God, he makes it that more, much more precious to him to have us and claim us as his own.
Well, when God breathed into man's nostrils the breath of life, and made him a living soul, I think part of that was imparting the free will. You know, everything else, you know, God's creation behaves either, you know, kind of somewhat mechanically or instinctively. You know, the beasts of the field do what they do, and instinctively. They don't sit and think about it. You know, if a lion is hungry, it will kill, you know, an animal to eat it. It's not the logical longer than the hundred to do that. Something about God's nature, you know, it has this free will, and of course I guess maybe he's the, you know, definition of free will. You know, and we've been given that, you know, as living souls, and you know, even the angels, you know, have free will. They're not forced to serve God, they do have the capacity to rebel.
Think about Satan and judgment day, and all these people are down there with him, and he's saying they don't want to be there. I'm going to be out of his mouth. Is your choice?
No.
They never realized they made that choice for themselves. Because they had the free will that they could have went a different direction. And Satan would have the same abilities as I did make it. That's why I suppose. Because he knows your God.
And the very thing that many people point to as a reason not to exist as God, or to believe in God, that he exists, is what makes God who he is. Because people say, how can God exist when there are so many bad things that happen in the world? But the bad things happen because God gave us free will. And in doing that, there will be people who will choose to do bad things. So that's part of who God is he gives us the ability to chart our own destinies. Provides the information and the encouragement for us to follow it, but he doesn't demand it. So, because of that very nature, people are going to choose not to follow God, as well as people choosing to follow God. So that makes a lot of terrible things in the world happen.
Well, yeah, ultimately, with the bad stuff that happens, I mean, it's our fault, you know, deceived by Satan. Gentlemen, I was talking about this the other day. Kind of indirectly, but you know, I made the statement talking to her. Well, you know, I think the Garden of Eden was eternal. If man never sinned, he'd still be there in some fashion. Okay. And from the instant of sin, that's when the clock really started ticking. We became time bound in a world that is slowly deteriorating. Okay. And yeah, when we see the children starving and all, you know, that is the result not of their sin, but of just the fact that we live in a fallen, you know, decaying world.
Most of the time when you look at those situations, if you trace back the roots, you see it came about as a result of government corruption or, you know,
we've got to take food in there, what's happening?
Yeah, you know, people's greed. You know, you look at the situation in Somalia where we were trying to bring food in and the warlords were taking it away and all that. Much of the pain in the world is self-inflicted. By other human beings. Okay, so let's read the paragraph 3.
Once his noble idea is to either take and have it, the creature are to be one with him, but give themselves merely the terms to them as assimilate them will not serve. He's prepared to do a little overriding at the beginning. He will set them off with communications of his presence, which start faint to engrave to them, with emotional sweetness and easy conquest over temptation. But he never allows this state of affairs to last long. Sooner or later he withdraws, if not in fact, at least from their conscious experience. all those support and incentive. He leads the creature to stand up on its own legs, to carry out from the will alone duties which have lost all relish. It is during such trial periods, much more than during the peak periods, that it is growing into the sort of creature he wants it to be. Hence, the prayers offered in the state of dryness are those which please him best. We can drag our patient along by continual tempting, because we design them only for the table, and the more their will is interfered with, the better. He cannot tempt to virtue as we do to vice. He wants them to learn to walk and must therefore take away his hand. And if only the will to walk is really there, he is pleased even with their stumble. Do not be deceived, Wormwood. Our cause is never more in danger than when a human, no longer desiring but intending to do our enemy's will, looks around upon a universe from which every trace of him seems to have vanished, and asks why he has been forsaken and still obeys. But of course the ground offered opportunities to our side also. Next week I will give you some hints on how to exploit them. Your affectionate Uncle Pluto.
Okay. In here about us growing during the frost of God, growing more spiritual during the frost of God. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I agree with it. I mean, if you cling to God during your hard times, you're going to come out on the other end spiritually a whole lot stronger than what you were going in. But of course, on the other hand, it can go the other way too. You know, you have people too that when they go through these hard times, throw up their hands and say, you know, it's not worth it. But I'm talking from my own experiences. Hard times that I had to go through on the other end made me spiritually a whole lot stronger than what I was when I first went there.
You're saying we have the opportunity to grow during the cross,
exactly.
But it's not here.
That's because God goes back to us at the time. If we get alone, it's because we need God, not the other way around.
That's even in the letter here, he says God doesn't really withdraw. He just withdraws from our sight, you know, so that we can't see him and feel him around us, but he hasn't really gone. He's still there, we just can't tell.
I agree with this because you hear people say, you know, where was God when this or that happened, or where was he when I had to go through this or that? My point is that I would say, were you even looking for him in those times, you know? And that's where you start seeing the difference. If you look for him in those times, you will find him. You will see where he was there and how he supported you and how he strengthened you. But if you look for blame and not really look for him, you won't.
Yeah, that's true. During difficult times, you can either pull closer to God or you can pull away from God. Sometimes the first thing people want to do is blame God. Situations like in Japan. They say, how could God let something like that happen? Sometimes provides difficulties like that as an opportunity for us to show whether we're really Christian. If somebody needs help, it's an opportunity for us to grow with the Christian and help them.
A lot packed in here where he talks about he wants him to learn to walk, therefore he must take away his hand. I mean, that's perfect energy. You know, the little baby, you know, for it to grow, he's got to learn to walk. He can't crawl forever. And, you know, the first time, whether you got to be willing to sit down there with Dad and say, okay, go see Daddy and let go.
Yeah.
Knowing the kid's going to go two steps and probably fall on their face and bounce. Okay.
You have to let go of the bicycle without the training wheels. Learning to walk, you know they're going to stumble. But you have to do that for you.
It's a very good example.
catch us before we fall every time. Very pick us up after that. What do you think about the sentence in there that where he says our cause is never more in danger than when a human no longer desiring but intending to do our enemy's will looks around upon a universe in which every trace of him seems to have vanished, asks why he has been forsaken and still obeys.
Jesus is a very good example of that.
Yep.
What?
Jesus.
Oh, yes.
A very good example. But yet he obeys.
Okay. What about the phrase no longer desiring but intending?
It's an impression of from the demonic perspective there. It's like, okay, he's really tired. In his own will, doesn't really want to do this. You know, the patient or the, you know, the victim's own will. But, you know, he takes a deep breath and sighs. And he wants to, he intends to obey, but his own desire is not really there. He involves him, you know, in that situation. He goes ahead, does it anyway.
Yeah, I agree to help at the church Saturday morning, so I guess I'm
gonna... I really don't want to get out of there.
Yep. Yeah. Got to do this DBS stuff. Better go help him.
And that's where the, you know, that's where the rewards come. Because you do find out when you do that, that, you know, God's not, he's not run off. The universe is not empty. And that's kind of what he's waiting for. You know, God's waiting for that trigger. Go ahead and do it. Okay. And then he's, you know, grinning from ear to ear, Satan screaming bloody murder. You know, his job just got a lot tougher.
And when you override your yeah, desires and do what you know you're supposed to do, you're always glad you did.
Is on that point, Satan's greatest fear is to see our faith increase. And that, as he fears that, because when you start doing things, even when you're down and things seem like there's no end to it, it's hopeless, and you continue to persevere, oh, Satan, that really gets in right there.